Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Welcome to the OC, bitches. It's your turn, Rachel.
Oh, welcome to the OC, bitches. I'm chewing.
chewing on a podcast. Oh, no. Okay, everybody. Rachel and I have a few episodes that we're doing. We're calling them cultural episodes. And I just want to say that when, Rachel, you called me to do this podcast, the very first thing I did was get this book. So we'll talk about it because our guest today, from his early years as a columnist at Tony Soprano's favorite newspaper, the Star-Ledger, to present day as Rolling Stone's chief TV critic, it's been said that Alan Sepinwall has changed the nature of television criticism and is the acknowledged king of the form regarding his weekly episode recaps and reviews. Alan was an early OC-aholic and even wrote a book entitled Stop Being a Hater and Learn to Love the OC. And next to Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage, and he is the foremost critical expert on the OC. And Rachel, you and I could learn a lot from him. So welcome, Alan Sepinwall.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on.
It's my absolute pleasure.
Nothing I like more than to talk to someone who can just give Josh Schwartz hell.
Oh, Josh, that guy. I've had about enough of him, I think.
Well, I guess one of my first thoughts was, how does one become the television critic for Rolling Stone? And how did it all begin?
All right. Well, let's see here. Let me see the shortest and least tedious version of this I can tell.
Okay.
I went to college in the 90s. The internet was a new thing then. So the idea of writing for the internet was a novelty. And I wound up writing a lot about a TV show called NYPD Blue. And nobody was doing stuff like that at the time. And it helped me get a job at the Star-Ledger writing about television. And so I was doing that for a long time. I wound up writing several books, including the one you mentioned, Melinda. Then I went online for a while to a couple of sites called HitFix and UpRocks. And eventually Rolling Stone came calling. And it's been a lot of fun being there for the last few years.
Yeah, I would imagine that's a lot of fun, especially watching everything that's out there today, because I feel like there is so much content. I don't know. How do you keep up with it and how do you do what you do?
I don't know, Rachel. I really don't know. There's so, like, just looking back to when the OC debuted versus now, I could keep up with pretty much every show. Like, even the things that I wasn't a huge fan of, I could still watch a handful of episodes every year just to check in, because sometimes shows get better. Sometimes they get worse, and it's just sort of useful to keep that in mind. Now there's just no way. Now there are shows that I really, really like, and I'm several years behind. So it's just a matter of, like, sort of triage, and you figure out, all right, well, I can write about this, I can watch that, and sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't, and you just sort of have to hold your breath and hope you can get to as much of it as you can.
So you are, I've learned so much getting prepared for this, that this is considered the second golden era of television, starting with The Sopranos. Is that correct? And,
yes.
And you have been a huge voice for that era. And how much has the industry changed since then and now? You mentioned the internet and such.
Oh, it's so much. I mean, when I started doing this in the mid-90s, it was pretty much just broadcast TV. It was ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, and that was all anybody cared about television. There were a handful of other places. And now there's just, you can get content from anywhere. Like, I will announce a review of a show on some new streaming service, and people on Twitter will say, you're making that up. Like, that is not a real thing that exists. That is not a place. You know, sometimes they last a long time. Sometimes, like Quibi, they, you know, come and go in about a week. So it's just, there's so many more places to get content. There's so many more shows, and there's so many more kinds of shows, and, like, so much more ambitious than they used to be. And I think the biggest way that TV has changed is when I started doing this and I would tell people what I did for a living, their initial response would be, okay, do you write about movies too? And when I said I didn't, they would almost feel sorry for me. Huh. And then at a certain point, I would say I write about TV for a living, and they would get this look on their face of delight, and they would kind of lean in and say, have you seen The Wire? Or, you know, have you seen this show Breaking Bad? And they were so excited to talk about them. And it's like the esteem for the medium has really just skyrocketed in the time I've been doing this.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it, but it must be a lot of fun too. I mean, it sounds like a fun job to me. Not easy, but fun.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. Like it's, I have, as jobs go, this is pretty high on the fun meter. It's also just a ton of work just to keep track of things. And, you know, it used to be you would review a show. Like, I think I reviewed The OC off of a single episode. Maybe Fox sent us the one where you guys were in the swimming pool, but that was about it. Now, like, they'll send me an entire season before I have to review something, which means I've now got to make like 10 hours to get through it before I can write about it.
Well, that was my question. So when you're reviewing a show, is it basically like they'll send you the pilot and you review that? Or are you supposed to review like the whole season in one fell swoop?
It varies. It depends sort of on how much they have ready. You know, streaming shows and premium cable shows, they tend to have more available in advance. But it really kind of varies. And I think COVID has definitely put a crimp in things, and it's harder to get stuff early. So sometimes these days I'll only get two or three shows. But like, it's very rare that I'm asked to review something off of only one episode. Because when you do that, it's less a review and more me trying to be a psychic. It's me like looking at it and saying, well, does this thing I like, is that going to stay good? Or are they going to move away from that? Is this one little minor bad thing going to get worse, or is it going to stay at that size? So there used to be a lot more guesswork, and at least now it's more time consuming, but I feel like I can make a much more informed judgment on what I like and what I don't and why.
That sounds fair to the shows.
There's something that you're well known for. You're well known to be a vocal advocate for certain shows over the years. And I love this story, and I'm going off of our subject a little bit, but you're credited as partially saving Chuck from cancellation. Tell us about that.
Okay, so Chuck, which is another Josh Schwartz show, I really like that one a lot. It was in its second season. The ratings it was getting at the time would make it the most popular show on television now, because the audience is fragmented so much. But back then it was sort of like on the bubble for renewal. And there was this big question about whether NBC wanted it back, whether they even liked it. And so I decided to use my column at the Star Ledger, and I wrote an open letter to Ben Silverman, the head of NBC at the time, saying like, I really love Chuck, and here is why you should bring it back. And I sort of tried to argue it from both a business standpoint and a creative standpoint. And a few weeks later, after they announced the renewal and Ben Silverman was doing a press conference to talk about the fall schedule, I said, you know, why did you bring Chuck back? And Ben, because he was a showman, says, oh, it was because of you, Alan. And I mean, I think he was being very dramatic when he said that. And if there wasn't money in it, they wouldn't have done it. But, you know, when the legend becomes fact, you print the legend. And therefore, I'm the guy who saved Chuck.
For sure you are. Well, I think that, you know, it brings us to the other Josh Schwartz show, the smaller one called The OC, which...
Oh, don't even say that. It's
hey, I was on Chuck too. I worked at a deli.
Yes, you made those great sandwiches.
I sure did. Mortadella. Listen, I got it all right. Put me in a deli. I know my meats.
That's good.
So, yeah. So, you know, The OC, obviously, I feel like way back in the beginning of it, we talked about this book you wrote, right?
Yeah.
Stop being a hater and learn to love The OC. Well, a little bit of a sting, but still, nonetheless, love for the show.
This was not my title of choice, by the way. This was something that the publisher came up with.
Really? Well, what was your title? Do you remember?
I think the original title was going to be like a riff on Kubrick. It was like How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love The OC or something like that. I think they figured correctly that the target demo for this book would not be aware of like an early 60s Stanley Kubrick film. And so
that's fair.
They went for some more current slang.
Got it. Okay. So that's how the title came about. What about the book in general? Like what, you know, motivated you to write it? And let's just get into it.
Well, I had always wanted to write books. You know, it's like that's, you know, you write a newspaper column and that's great and you still have something like to put away, but it's still pretty ephemeral. Most people are recycling their newspapers after a day or a week, and a book is something people are going to put on their shelves. So that's cool, but I hadn't figured out how to do it yet. And then I just basically got cold called by a publisher at Penguin saying, we really like this show, The OC. People seem really excited about it. We think it's important to get a book on the shelves as quickly as we possibly can. If we gave you a month, can you write us a whole book? Yeah. And that's like, that is not normally the timeline for these things. I've written now five books total. The others I did over a period of like years in some cases. This I had to bang out over several weeks.
That is insane.
Yes. Yes, it is. And but the thing is, you know, I've always been a fast typist and I'm like a quick thinker. And so I was able to do it.
So you say you're a quick thinker. Would you say that you are kind of like a Seth yourself?
Yeah, very much so. I will wear that mantle. I mean, I don't think I'm not as cool as Seth at like his coolest. And I certainly don't have the musical taste he does. But like, let's just say I got a lot of the references and certainly related a lot to what he was going through, especially early on in the show.
Well, going back to the to 2003, you know, we're exploring this, the cultural impact of the show. And why do you think it resonated so strongly with the audience?
Well, it's interesting because like Josh will always say when people tried to compare it to, you know, 90210 or other soaps, Josh would say, I didn't watch that. I was a Seinfeld guy. But I think that's sort of what made it work is it was a soap written by somebody who had not grown up on soaps, didn't have like a built-in affection for the genre. So he was approaching it in a very different way. The fact that like the two main characters, at least initially, were boys was a very big thing. Like I certainly have watched a soap or 12 in my day, but I don't know that like I would have fallen in love with this one enough to like write a whole book about it if I didn't have a point of view character like Seth, you know, right away as prominently as he was. So like I was not the target viewer for the show. I was like 29, about to turn 30 when it debuted, you know, and I had a wife and a baby at that point. But like it was really smart and very clever. And it didn't feel like people would try to do a show like this every couple of years and they mostly failed. And this one just had a voice that was something new and fresh and exciting. And it was a blend of not only soap opera, but comedy and music and all of the other things that you guys know so well from having been such, you know, integral parts of it.
I read something interesting. You said something about Seth and Ryan being front and center. Now, my question to you is, why is that a feminist choice?
Well, because I think a lot of the time in soaps, if you have a female lead and you're looking for trouble, there's sort of a tendency to say, all right, well, our main character has to do something stupid here in order to perpetuate the drama. And here are the two stupid guys were Ryan and Seth. Like, they're the ones always kind of making the mistakes and making fools out of themselves or getting into fights or getting into trouble. And Summer especially was much smarter than either of them. And so, like, she was a very strong character. Julie is sort of introduced, at least initially, as a villain. And very quickly we realized, too, she's way smarter and funnier than she has been given credit for by Jimmy and by everybody. I think it was very smart in the way it kind of slow rolled the development of all the characters, but especially the women on the show, while the focus, at least in the first handful of episodes, was on Ryan and Seth and Sandy.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I never thought about it that they were the front and center and the main. I mean, of course, they were the leads and stuff, but I never thought about it from that perspective that it was actually two males.
Yeah, and that's just like, I mean, even on 90210, it was a brother and a sister. Like that's usually about as far as you would get with this kind of thing. It's a genre that tends to stereotypically appeal more to female viewers. And so the idea is you want to have a main character who your target audience is going to empathize with in some way.
Is it fair to say, though, for instance, there were certain shows that were geared towards the men and certain shows that were geared towards the women. So the men were, okay, NYPD Blue, and maybe they would gear, you know, these soaps towards women. And that is why the OC, and you can tell me if you agree, the OC didn't talk down to its audience.
No, it didn't. It was really, it's sort of, it's four quadrant in the sense that like it's appealing to, you know, across genders, but also across demographics, because Sandy and Kirsten and Julie and the adults were fun in their own right. Like, you could do stories about them and it didn't feel like, wait, why are we doing this? Like, let's get back to the kids. That's why what I'm here for. And so you could draw in like a slightly older viewer like me at the time and have them really enjoy it just as much as you could, you know, the teenagers who just thought that like Summer and Marissa were like the two best humans on the planet.
Well, I don't know about that. But, you know, for me, rewatching it now for this podcast, because I'm a mom and I'm 40, and so I can relate more to the parent storylines. And I'm watching it now from that perspective, like, oh my God, like I'm, you know, the Kirsten. I haven't been the Julie yet. You know, maybe later on I could relate. Hopefully not, because of what's to come. But it's just interesting to watch it back. And you're right that it had the right combination of kind of something for everyone, so to speak. I would say that's probably a fair assessment.
Yeah, and I don't even think that, like, if you were to ask Josh, I don't think that's what he was trying to do. I just think Josh, like, sort of has such affection for all of his characters, and it's very palpable. It comes across. So even the people who were, like, villainous early on, like Julie or like Luke, very quickly they sort of, you know, get absorbed into the group because there's awesome things about them, too. And they become lovable because Josh loved them.
You say, you're honest, the first sentence in your book is, "Hi, my name is Alan. I'm an OC-aholic. I'm 30 years old with a wife, a baby, and a little house in the suburbs. What the hell am I doing spending my Wednesday nights glued to a soap opera about pretty teenagers and their parents in a posh gated community? Question mark."
Look, you got to own it. You got to be like right out front. But I think that sort of, that also speaks to what we're talking about, which is this was a show that, like, you know, for this brief, glorious period of a few years there, exploded well beyond like the target audience for this kind of show. You know, Josh has done a bunch of other young adult dramas since then. I think they're very well done, but they have not necessarily spoken to me in the same way that this did. This just sort of had like the perfect mix of elements. So even though I was not like the people that Fox was marketing to, I was just super into it.
Yeah. So over the years, you've had quite a few in-depth interviews and conversations with Mr. Schwartz himself.
Yep.
You know, I have to say, like, anyone that can give Josh a hard time, just like, are my favorite people, because he, you know, he doesn't take criticism well. He is our little, you know, neurotic person that he is. He's like my brother. I'm allowed to say these things. But yeah, so, you know, so I'm a big fan of yours for being able to just give him shit when needed. But so you've had all these interviews and you've talked about things like what worked, what didn't work, and specifically about the OC. But I'm just curious, like, for our people listening that maybe haven't read the interviews or whatever, if you could tell us about what you thought did not work with storylines or characters or things that you weren't into, or, you know, any examples like
when
that
you had
to be
a TV critic.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things, and Josh has been very candid about this, he was a young guy. He was 27, 28 when he made the show, something like that. And he had never made a TV show before. And so one of the things he didn't really know how to do was pacing. And I think that really worked to the show's advantage early on. Like, this just went boom, boom, boom. Things kept happening. Like, the Tijuana episode is, I think, the 7th episode. A show now, that would be their season finale, you know, or that would be like season 2. And he just got to that right away. And all of these things happened, event on top of event. Like, Seth is suddenly in a love triangle with Summer and Anna, like, almost immediately. It's just all of this stuff is happening. It's really crazy. And on the one hand, that made that first season so much fun to watch. On the other hand, like, he burned up so many story ideas that he could have used to fill many more seasons after that. And he's been very candid as saying, like, when he came back for year 2 and year 3, it was a real struggle to, like, well, what are we going to do now? Like, we did all this. And so in some cases, they wound up repeating themselves. In some cases, they wound up introducing new characters who did not fit in as well, although some of them did. And in some cases, they wound up, like, inserting some dramatic strife to characters for whom we didn't want to see it. Like, I don't want Sandy and Kiki's marriage to go on the rocks. I love Sandy and Kirsten. Like, they're one of the great married couples in TV history. Don't mess with that. Just let them be happy and funny and talk about yoga lattes. It's okay.
You're not a fan of Rebecca.
Not so much. No. None of these sort of, like, obstacles and, you know, various reasons for them fighting when, like, Jeff Hefner showed up, all of that. It's like, right. No, just, it's like, I understand the desire to want to give them stuff to do because they're really great actors. and their beloved characters. It's just, it's a tough thing to have happen. So there was some of that. And then there was a point, and Josh is still mad at me about this, where I was sometime in, I think, season three, when there was like Johnny and Chili and Volchok and all of that stuff happening. And Marissa as a character was just sort of like, now she was in trouble every week. And it was no longer Seth and Ryan who were the ones doing the stupid things. It was Marissa was kind of being dumb constantly and being self-destructive. And I got very impatient about it. And I was recapping the show every week. And I would sort of, there would be like a weekly section where I was just complaining about Marissa. And Josh would say years later, like, you're not the only reason I killed Marissa, but you were a big reason I killed Marissa. And I blame you because everyone got mad at me for that. So and I was in like an ATX festival reunion of everybody a few years ago, back when we could all still go to festivals and stuff. And we started talking about him killing Marissa. And there was a bunch of like women in their 20s in the audience, and they had clearly grown up on the show. And like, as soon as we started talking about like whatever role I had inadvertently played in this, it was like they all just wanted to attack me. They were not happy with me at that point.
Yeah, well, we've clarified right here today that, Alan, you are the reason Marissa was killed off of the OC. So everyone, you want to blame someone, Alan, it's on you.
I saved Chuck and I killed Marissa. Fine, I accept it.
So, as a showrunner, it's not the best idea to become friendly with the critic of... No, but yeah. Clearly you created a friendship with Josh and did interviews over the years and had different dialogues, and he listened. Yes. He listened. I mean, he admittedly listened to message boards and and critics.
And he has said in hindsight he shouldn't have done that, and I think that's right. I mean, it's a tricky line to walk, I think, sometimes, because there can be times when a showrunner will listen too much to the feedback and not to their own sort of gut. But there's also times when, like, the showrunner is a little too insulated and doesn't realize how certain stories are coming across to the audience, and they sort of keep digging themselves in deeper. And it's a really hard thing to figure out, like, when to listen and when not to. And I certainly would not have the level of intuition needed to decide, you know, yay or nay on that.
Right. So you talked about all like the thing, or not all, but a lot of the things that you thought, you know, didn't work and some fun examples. But what about the things that did? Like, what were your favorite parts of the show?
I loved how funny it was. I loved how funny all of you were. I know like season four, there's people who just felt like if the show was running on fumes at that point. But I love that season so much because it was like, once Marissa was gone and they sort of the characters had a chance to mourn, you could tell that Josh and Stephanie and everybody else decided, all right, we're just going to be funny. This will be the funny season. And, you know, you've got Chris Pratt running around and Rachel, were you wearing a beaver costume? I'm trying to remember what the mascot was.
You know what? I wouldn't put it past me. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Beaver. Yeah. So there, you know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff. And Taylor Townsend, who is a super funny character, and, you know, all the sort of wacky stuff happening. So I love that. I loved the music. You know, I certainly, you know, as I said before, like I did not have the most like, you know, cutting edge musical palette. Like I was just listening to a lot of like Springsteen and hair metal and stuff like that growing up. But like, I loved every time they would go to the bait shop and somebody would perform. I just loved the use of the songs and how dramatic it was. I liked the romance. I think it was like the show did really well with the core relationships, Seth and Summer especially. Like it very rarely felt like those characters, when they were being pulled apart, were being pulled apart just for mechanical reasons. It felt like, okay, no, this makes sense why, you know, she would be annoyed with him or he would be annoyed with her in that moment. They had a really good handle on those characters.
I like that. Thank you. Like, I'm going to take credit for some of it.
Why do you think though? I mean, what are your thoughts on nostalgia? Like, what and why is the show still so relevant in 2021? And what do you think the legacy of the show is?
Well, I mean, I'm big on like nostalgia. I've got a teenager and an almost teenager at this point, and I've spent a lot of time, especially over the last year and a half, when we've been just at home all the time, showing them my favorite shows growing up. And the younger of the two, I think we will get to the OC at some point in the next couple of years. And it's just, you're definitely seeing I don't feel like I'm alone in that. This idea I hear a lot anecdotally about parents like saying, all right, you know, now I'm going to share this with my kid. Or I'm just going to rewatch this because it reminds me of a time in my life I was very happy about. But I think beyond that, I think this show specifically, it ages well because it's really well written, because the characters are very well played. It's a really good cast. The fashion, for the most part, does not feel dated. I mean, I have not been watching every episode like you guys have, so you may disagree. But, like, I read a whole book about The Sopranos, and going back and rewatching that, and that overlapped with you guys for a few years, like, that very much feels like a period piece, and you're looking at, like, these track suits and the lacquered hair and everything, and we're like, okay, yes, this is 2003, I get that. And when I've gone back on the occasions when I've looked back at the OC, it doesn't feel that way to me. It feels more current, even though obviously the music and a lot of the other things are very specific to that time.
No, I think it holds up fashion-wise, music-wise. The fact that we just did a music episode and I realized how many 80s tunes they were using, how many, you know, different eras that they were using. And except, you know, we talked about the fact that I think cinematically it definitely looks a little dated from time to time. But I was just listening to an OC mix this morning and I was like, this is really cutting edge stuff now, it feels like to me, because I'm with you. I'm not up on the music at all, or I was not an expert at all, but I'm loving it. It's like, that's how I fold my socks and do my laundry. I listen to the OC mixes now because I'm rediscovering it.
There was a funny thing where Josh did a show a couple of years ago for Hulu called Looking for Alaska, which was set around the time of the OC. In one episode, the characters are watching an episode of the show. And like, he wound up using a bunch of songs from that period, including, I think, a few that had been on the OC soundtrack, but like new cover versions of it. So like, mid-2000s nostalgia is here and it's good. Like, I feel like we've dwelled much too long, in part, you know, because my generation, you know, has its hand on the controls at the moment, much too long in the 1980s. Let's move on. Let's get to 1990s nostalgia. Let's do a lot more 2000s nostalgia. And eventually I'm curious what 2010s nostalgia is going to look like.
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, like looking back, you think the fashion is... What's interesting about fashion in particular, which I'm going to talk about for a second, is that...
Yeah, please.
It always comes back full circle. And to see that, like, platform flip-flops, people are like... rocking platforms again, that's a big eye-opener for me because, like, everything comes back. So,
yep.
You know, but that time and the nostalgia of it all.
Crocs.
I'm wearing my Crocs.
Oh, I have Crocs. My Crocs are right here, too.
Although,
I will tell you, I never stopped wearing Crocs. When I was pregnant with my daughter, all I wore were Crocs on the set. I was on a show called Heart of Dixie, which I'm sure you loved, Alan.
I
was wearing Crocs and everyone made fun of me. And I was like, I don't care. I am comfortable.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
That's my little shout out to Crocs. But, you know, it's such a... I think everyone's kind of searching for nostalgia, especially right now with the pandemic and everything else. So to revisit all these things. So you said your younger daughter, you might show her the OC in a few years, but have you already showed your older child the OC?
No, I showed my the older one's the daughter, the younger one's the son.
Got it.
My daughter, we watched Chuck together. She is less into teen stuff. She was it was sort of never her speed, and so I could tell right away, like, let's just not do this. But my son is sort of very Seth Cohen-y in his own way, and so I would not be surprised if in a couple of years he is very into this.
Got it. Okay, that'll be cool.
So I have another question for you. You wrote another book called
Yes.
TV, the book.
And, oh yeah, I got that one here.
I have not read it. I don't have it, but
that's okay.
But so you and your writing partner, what's his name? I'm sorry.
Matt Zollersites.
Yes. So you guys came up with a criteria of the 100 best TV shows of all time.
Yes.
And a few of mine are in the top five, and the top five are... Do you remember? You know.
See, the top five is The Simpsons, The Sopranos, The Wire, Cheers, and Breaking Bad.
Okay. So we did not make the top 100, right?
No.
Were we?
Well, no, but okay. Here's what I will say about that. I did this book with Matt, you know, who used to be my writing partner at the Star Ledger, and we've collaborated on a few books since then. And it was sort of like we had to come to a meeting of the minds on these things. So if it was just me, the OC would have been in there somewhere. I don't know if it would have been in the top 100, but like we had a long honorable mention section sometimes where we wrote about like a season of a show that was really great and things like that. But Matt, like, this was not his jam at all. And at a certain point, like, I had pushed for this and he had pushed for that. And I realized I was not going to win this fight. So I killed Marissa, but Matt killed the OC from being in TV the Book.
So, but what you're saying is it didn't make the 100. It wouldn't have made the, it didn't even make the honorable section.
The, what's so the what section called? A Certain is, Regard, right?
A Certain Regard, yes.
Is it in there?
We talked about it, and I believe a foot was placed down, and when the foot comes down, there's nothing I can do.
Well, can you tell our audience, you had a very specific criteria, and I understand why the show wouldn't be in, would not have made the list because of that criteria.
Yes.
Okay,
so when we did TV the Book, we came up with the best way to judge art, honestly, is through math. And so we decided to come up with numbers. Hmm. No, we did this ranking system of five categories or six categories. It was innovation, influence, consistency.
On Valentine's Day 1929, a group of gangsters was massacred in a cold Chicago garage. The crime shook the country, and even though investigators had only just started looking for answers, everyone was sure they already knew who was behind the crime. Al Capone. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, a child of Italian immigrants sets out to make good on the promises of that dream. But Al Capone's path to success doesn't take him down the straight and narrow. Instead, he transforms himself from a smarter-than-your-average thug into the most infamous criminal America has ever known. Listen to American Criminal Al Capone wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Performance.
Get cash for clothes at Plato's Closet in North Charleston in West Ashley. It's so easy. Recycle, earn cash, repeat. We pay cash on the spot for your trendy, gently used clothing, shoes, and accessories. At Plato's Closet, we buy all seasons, all day, every day. It's time to clean out your closet and cash in. Bring in your denim, graphic tees, athletic wear, shoes, handbags, and more. Sell your styles to Plato's Closet for cash. Then, do it again. Plato's Closet, located in West Ashley on Sam Rittenberg Boulevard and North Charleston on Rivers Avenue.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Storytelling. I forget exactly. There may have been at Peak Value. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is we would rank each show from 1 to 10. So innovation, was it doing something nobody had done before? Influence was how much impact did it have on both the culture and on other TV shows? How many other shows were sort of inspired by it? Consistency, you know, it's performance. All those are sort of a little more self-explanatory. So I don't have the spreadsheet in front of me that we used, but I'm pretty sure the OC would have been really, really high in influence for me. Mm-hmm. It would not have been as high as in consistency because, like, there's some seasons that are fantastic, mm-hmm. some a bit less so. And then innovation, it would have done pretty well because it did not feel like a kind of soap opera that we had seen before. So I think I scored it pretty well, and I think Matt just kind of rolled his eyes and indulged me for a little while and finally said no.
Well, we're going to include this as our honorable mention.
Please.
What you just said.
So please do. You.
With a certain regard. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that it was fascinating that Simpsons was, because I appreciate The Simpsons, but I didn't quite get it. But then I saw an interview with you explaining why it beat out The Sopranos.
Yeah, I mean, it's the argument that we made, and Matt was like pro Sopranos and I was pro Simpsons. And in that case, I won. Like, sort of, I got the number one show in the book, and therefore I had to yield to him on certain other things. And I think part of the argument I made was just like, in terms of influence, in terms of innovation, like it just, it's a staggering impact that it was able to be as great as it was for basically a decade and still be good now, like 25 years later, however long they've been doing it, after that first decade, is really remarkable. Like, no show has ever been this good for this long. Mm-hmm. And it feels like, I mean, The Sopranos could very easily, if we revisit the book at some point, wind up in the number one spot, because we wound up doing a book on that and we loved it again. But The Simpsons is great. I love The Simpsons, and I think it's like a special show. Like, whenever I used to do like reader mail columns, any question about like what's the best example of this or what's the best example of that, I always would have to say, well, the real answer is The Simpsons, but I don't want to be boring, so the answer is this. Like, what's the best spinoff of all time? The Simpsons. You know, right. What's the best comedy of all time? The Simpsons. What's the best, like, most interesting TV family of all time? The Simpsons, etc. So I sort of have to refrain from doing that as much.
Well, I would agree. I mean, The Simpsons has been on since I was, I don't even know. I remember being in fourth grade, and Bart Simpson is eternally in fourth grade, and I was in love with Bart Simpson. What does that say about me being in love with a cartoon? Let's not. We don't have time to get into that, but I was a huge fan, so I get that.
Remember one time I was having a lunch before The Wire season 4 debuted, and that was the season with the kids in middle school. And so I'm like having a lunch with the actors who did the middle school arc. And they start talking to me about like the shows that I watched when I was their age. And I said, well, The Simpsons debuted around the time that I was in middle school or something like that. And one of them just looked at me and said, The Simpsons hasn't always been on TV. Like, it just kind of feels that way.
Yeah.
Like Sesame Street.
It's your other family member.
Hey, this just popped in to my head. So, Alan, are you still doing the podcast, Never Been Seen?
It's called Too Long Didn't Watch.
Too Long Didn't Watch. Sorry. Are you still doing
that's
it?
Okay. Yes, we're still doing it. We're on a hiatus right now. We're hopefully coming back sometime later this fall. We've got like 10 more episodes banked that I think people are really going to like. The gimmick for people who don't know is every episode, I find a celebrity guest. We pick a show they've never seen before. They watch the very first episode and the very last episode and nothing in between. And they have to figure out what happened. So, like, the very first time we did it, John Hamm watched the pilot and finale of Gossip Girl and had to, like, piece that together.
Can I pitch you something?
Please do.
Since Rachel hasn't seen this show, what if she watched the first episode of season 4 and the end of season 4, and she'll have to guess what happened in between?
Of the OC?
Of the OC.
Oh, so the whole thing is I don't remember. Everyone knows who listens. I don't remember anything about the show. Not anything I did. Not anything that happened. So everything is a surprise to me. So that's where she's going with it.
We did one episode in our first season with an actor who had been in the pilot, and then like they left because they couldn't continue on Gillian Jacobs from The Good Wife. But it would be interesting to have someone who was in the entire season and try to guess what happened in between.
Well, I'm your girl.
Okay.
As a critic, though, this is just a personal question. Like, how is it? Do you deliver constructive criticism? I mean, have you had a lot of people come back and just be so angry at you, or, you know, how does that
work? There was one. I mean, I like you sort of alluded to the fact that I'm friendly with Josh, and that's happened over the years with some showrunners and some actors. And I sort of, it's like, it's not the ideal thing because then like I'm critiquing their work, but I've never tried to like write mean when I'm negative. So that's part of it. But like, I really try very hard to separate my affection for the person with my feelings for the show, or vice versa. There's some shows by people I hate where I really like the show, and I have to be frank with that. And Josh, to his credit, like sort of has always respected the idea that like, if I didn't like something he was doing, or if I didn't think it was for me, he would let that go. He was okay with it. There have, however, been a few showrunners over the years with whom I had a very good relationship at one point, and then I did not have a good relationship with them at another point. And I will just say my behavior did not change, but perhaps my writing did. And that, interesting. That is all I will say about that.
Okay. Could you tell us what one of your least favorite shows of all time was?
Least favorite show? Oh, my God. There's even now, there's a lot of bad TV just because there's so much TV in general. But let's... The problem is, like, growing up, I watched a lot of just absolute garbage, you know? It was like any show with, like, a fast car or a fast motorcycle or a helicopter. My ringtone is from, like, this really bad ABC drama from the 80s called Airwolf with, like, Jan Michael Vincent flying an attack helicopter just because I really like the synthesizer beat. The show is not good at all. But in terms of the worst show ever, oh, my God, there was one I reviewed early in my career called Homeboys in Outer Space. That I'm probably being harder on just because of the title. And I think if I was to actually go back and look at it, there have definitely been worse ones than that. But that always sort of stands out because of the name. There was a UPN show called The Secret Diary of Desmond Pfeiffer with Chi McBride, who is a really great actor, as like Abraham Lincoln's butler in the Civil War. Yes. And it's like revisionist history. It's really just messed up and not good.
So. You know, I have this absolute picture in my mind of Alan in the 80s being that Seth guy. Were probably already coming to school and talking with your friends about these shows the same way Summer's talking about The Valley.
A little bit, although the thing is, the internet really helped me because a lot of the shows I liked growing up were not always, like, I've always been sort of demographically out of step. Like, I would watch shows that were too old for me, and then with the OC, I was watching a show that was arguably too young for me. So I remember a lot of the time, like, I would come to school and be so excited to talk about these things, and my friends had no idea what the hell I was talking about. Like, you know, when Twin Peaks was on, I came into school and it was like, guys, I can't believe who killed Laura Palmer.
Right.
What? Who's Laura Palmer? Did someone get murdered? What happened?
But, you know, our art and television, it's so subjective. Even if, even if logically we know that, okay, that's silly, it's stupid. What, you know, this suspension of disbelief, just the fun of it, just allowing yourself to, you know, being constructively critical, I get that. Being negative and mean, doesn't help anything, right? But it must just be, I don't know, it's just a wonderful, I love television. I love this show. Yeah. I love the industry. I love people's success. I don't necessarily revel in people's failures. You know, it's just, it's having someone like you out there is just very refreshing, in my opinion.
Well, thank you. I mean, I try. Like, it's certainly when I was younger, I would probably write like some sort of nastier stuff because it's fun. Like, that's the thing you do when you're in your teen or early 20s. Like, ooh, let's see how creatively I can insult someone. And that's just, it's a very immature thing. The better writers grow out of it. I know some never have, but like at a certain point you realize like people are making these shows, people are in these shows, and maybe the show isn't working and maybe it's not good for this reason or that reason. But like you can talk about why it's not working without just like insulting their family or their appearance or anything else. Just like there's a way to do it. And I like to think that I have figured out a way to like be honest without being nasty about it.
Do you take criticism of your criticisms well?
I do. I mean, you know, my wife would definitely say like I'm very sensitive to criticism at home, which is ironic. But in terms of like if somebody looks at a thing I've written about something they like, and they point out a flaw in my logic or something I got like wrong factually or whatever. Mm-hmm. I will absolutely listen to that and, you know, cop to the fact that I messed up. What I found, though, is like there's a lot of people want to be on teams. If they love a show, they want everyone to love the show. And anyone who doesn't, who's even like mixed about the show, is in some ways like impugning their character and saying like, oh, you're a terrible person because you like this thing. So they're like, I found that on the internet, especially, people get very sensitive to any, like even the slightest bit of criticism about the thing that they like. And that's tough. But, you know, I can only give my opinion and do what I can with that.
It has been so much fun talking to you, Alan. And like I said, I appreciate anyone that gives Josh Schwartz shit. So for that alone, I'm a huge fan. But yeah, it's been so much fun having you here and picking your brain. And honestly, just, you know, kind of seeing behind the curtain of the other side of things when talking to a TV critic, because we're, you know, the ones you're criticizing. So,
yes. Just remember, critics are people too. That's what I want you to come away from this one.
Yeah, that's the takeaway.
Well, no, the takeaway is to become good friends with the critics and hopefully, no.
Apparently then, that doesn't save you.
The takeaway is that I killed Marissa and I'm not repentant about it. I would do it again.
Anybody who is interested, this is really a fun read. And you even have like a guide to Newport Beach in here because I grew up in Orange County. Okay, that's a drinking game. Go ahead and drink. I said it. And I love it. Like, I was like, wait, you can go north. You go to Fashion Island. You have this whole, and you did this in less than a month. That's hysterical.
Well, and the funny thing is, the one memory I have of doing this was, because it was it's an unauthorized guide. It's unofficial. We weren't making it in conjunction with Warner Brothers or Fox or anybody. So as a result, the publisher kept telling me there are certain legal restrictions on, like, they're like, you're doing too much plot summarizing. You can't do that. You're doing too much. So a lot of the things that are in the book are there mainly because I was sort of trying to get around, like, what I was allowed and not allowed to talk about. Huh. And I was trying to stick to the show as much as I possibly could. But there were some days where I'm like, okay, what am I going to do here? I will do a guide to Newport Beach. Sure, I can do that.
I wonder if all those things are still there today. If we revisit the guide and go through it, we'll have to do that sometime, Mindy.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. This has been so much fun.
Grace Perry, she is an author. Her debut book, The 2000s Made Me Gay, she wrote a collection of essays that are a hilarious, nostalgic trip through the beloved 2000s media, interweaving cultural criticism and personal narrative looking through the lens of popular characters of the time, one being our very own Seth Cohen. She is also a longtime regular contributor to The Onion and the feminist satire site Reductress. Please welcome Grace. Hello, Grace.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. It's such a treat.
Well, we're so happy that you're here and willing to talk to us. we couldn't be more thrilled. So thank you for joining us today.
Discovering people like you who've written books, and it's not just the OC, but the aughts and how you formed your years or your formative years were defined by the 2000s. And I'm just excited. I'm totally excited to hear your perspective because it's such a fascinating one. And I don't think it's explored that much.
Mm. Yeah, I think that people are like, I was born in 1989. So like the 2000s were really right when I was like middle school and then like to beginning of college. So like that super, like just time of so much change and so much like figuring yourself out, figuring your identity. And not just in terms of like sexuality, which is obviously sort of what the book mostly revolves around for me, but also just like who you are, what your taste is, what you want to do with your life, all that stuff. And so I was such a, you know, and I still am such like a pop culture sponge, but, you know, especially at that time, I think that the kind of media that you're taking in has such, it can have such a profound impact on the kind of person that you turn into, and just like what you're interested in, what your values are. The OC was, you know, was such an iconic show of the 2000s, you know, and I was like right in the high school, sweet spot for that, it was huge for me and for my peers. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, that time isn't, so I'm a little bit older than you, but the early aughts, as they say. I just learned that, by the way, that the 2000s and early 2000s are called the early aughts. Josh Schwartz informed me of that. Such an interesting time. And then, you know, us being introduced to your book, which I had so much fun with, and I think you're an incredible writer. And
oh, thank you.
You know, mainly the title itself, you know, it really stands out. So the 2000s made me gay. So I wanted to kind of get into that and see, you know, let's talk about that and the title and where that came from.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little tongue in cheek, but also not like, you know, the main thing for me was like, you know, the way that I think about the kind of stuff I was watching when I was a kid is like, there were so few like queer characters, openly gay, like, you know, characters in the kind of entertainment content, whatever that we were taking in versus like the 2010s, which like you have way more, you know, LGBT representation in TV, film, books, whatever. In my book, I attribute a lot of that change. Like Glee was sort of a turning point, I think, in a lot of ways. But at the same time, like, you know, as I was saying before, I was still 14 and looking for a sense of myself in TV and also sort of replicating what I was seeing on TV. And so it's not a book that's about like a guide to like all of the gay characters on TV in the 2000s. It's like the characters that I was into and that I think like actually shaped me. Right. So, you know, one example is like Buffy the Vampire Slayer is like a huge cultural touchstone for like lesbians and for just like queer representation. Like there's so much like academic writing on Buffy, but like, I don't write about Buffy at all in the book because like it was on when I was like 11. Like mm-hmm. I didn't latch onto it in the same way that like, it was so formative for so many other people who were like maybe a few years older than me. So for me, I have like the OC, which, you know, there is like, you know, there's the Marissa and Alex storyline, but for me, it was really more about like Seth as this sort of, you know, Seth is obviously, you know, he's straight, but like, there is something that for me really like, was like, ooh, I like this person. I'm like drawn to this person. And I want to sort of like, do I have a crush on this person or do I want to be this person? Like, what is this? And Seth really, you know, just like exemplified that for me. I think like the sort of trite way of putting it is like, oh, Seth Cohen is a lesbian, which like is not true. But it's still kind of the, you know, is the way you could sort of package it in a tweet, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and that makes me reflect on something that you said that I wanted to quote here. There are so many ways to be attracted to someone. People get stuck in my head for many reasons other than wanting to sleep with them. Do I want to be this person or do I want to fuck this person? That's very thought-provoking and it's very true. And let's expand on that because I thought that was so interesting that attraction comes in so many different forms. You know, I'm attracted to my girlfriend because of her fashion sense or her personality, mm-hmm. or we love the same things. We finish each other's sentences. We're great at board games together. Those kinds of things. That's what I think is wonderful about what you're exploring in this book. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, of course. Like the chapter where I write about Seth, it's really kind of the core of it is there's this question, you know, that you just quoted. It's like, do I want to be this person or do I want to be with this person? And that's sort of a well-explored thing in a lot of like queer writing. And I think it really comes up, especially when you're a teenager or when you're, you know, young or just at any age when you're like figuring out your sexuality. And so it can get confusing. I think if you're attracted to people of the same gender, then you're like, do I want to be a friend of this person? Do I want to like date this person? Is this a role model? And I think that's, you know, it's especially true for queer people, but I think it's true for everybody, right? Like, I think that, you know, exactly what you're saying, Melinda, is like, you can be attracted to somebody as like a creative collaborator or as a mentor or as, you know, all different kinds of things. I think for queer people, it's often, you know, someone of the same gender who you're like, I have a crush on this person, or do I want to, you know, be friends with this person, or do I want to be them? And so with Seth, the same thing is happening. What's happening for me as a teenager, but it was flipped. Right. So my attraction to Seth, like I saw myself being attracted to Seth as this like sort of somebody I wanted to emulate, right? Like he's so funny and chatty and has great taste in music and is just like, he was so like cool and interesting in so many ways. And I think, you know, when I was a teenager and was not, you know, in touch with my sexuality or who I wanted to be or who I wanted to date or anything, I immediately flagged that as like, oh, I have a crush on Seth. Like, that's what's happening here. And sort of, it's really only in retrospect or, you know, a few years, like once I was in college and really started like figuring myself out a little more is I was like, oh, I didn't have a crush on Seth. Like, I just wanted to be Seth. Like, I just was like, so in search for some kind of like queer role model or somebody on TV. And like, there really weren't many at that time at all that I was like, is Seth Cohen is the one that I want to be. And like, it's so funny. Like there were like so many boys at my high school who had the same experience with Seth, right? Where they were like there's this guy I was friends with who like, you know, he was this like sort of, you know, like stoner hippie kind of guy, and then started watching The OC, and then started wearing like the corduroys and the Argyle sweaters, and like listening to Death Cab for Cutie, and like doing the whole Seth Cohen thing. So like, I think it was really, I think it's probably something a lot of like boys at the time related to too. But you know, since I'm queer, I was like, oh, same. So that's sort of the, you know, the gist of my love for Seth is this weirdly sort of an adolescent role model.
Yeah, I feel like that. I feel like I've heard that before, and I've heard the Seth Cohen like is a lesbian comparison before as well. Like, it just represents something. And you know, there was another quote to touch on what Melinda quoted, where you said being drawn to a person is so much richer and more dynamic than just the physical. And like, mm-hmm. I know it touches on what you just said, but it's also, it's just so true. And I think it's so relevant, especially today, and especially for youth, you know, coming up and growing up and figuring themselves out, which is very, you know, tumultuous and interesting. But, you know, I just think it is being drawn to people and seeing past the physical and really getting to know these people and know yourself is such like an amazing discovery. And I just love how you kind of went through that, and you used all of these, you know, these pop culture and shows and entertainment and everything to kind of like parallel your journey. And in reading, the chapter where you were really kind of talking about how, you know, the OC came about and like the Seth of it all was Banter Boys. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I want to ask, what would you say is a banter boy, first of all?
Okay, so I'm kind of like, this is my sort of like fake academic query about, you know, teen TV shows of the 2000s. But like banter boys, like Seth really epitomizes that for me. Jim Halpert in The Office also is like totally same genre. And then there's like Christian from Moulin Rouge, Ewan McGregor's character, and like Cliff from Bring It On. It's like these sort of like soft boys who are very really clever. Like there's always this sort of sense of where, whatever the situation they're in, whatever the scene is, like, you know, in The Office or in Newport Beach or whatever, they have this sort of sense of like, I don't belong here, and that there's something bigger for me outside of this. And that often comes about in these really like, in them being really creative. My sense is that it's like a way for male writers to sort of put themselves into the characters and sort of like, you know, but I think it is, so the sense of like being really clever. So when it comes up for Seth, like, obviously like he has his, you know, he's super witty, he's great sense of music. Like he has all that creativity. For Jim Halpert, it's him doing like the Office Olympics and coming up with all these pranks. And, so there's always that creative side to it. But I think that also something that really defined all these characters is this sort of like lover boy thing, right? Like it's that like Seth having a crush on Summer, Seth loving Summer it's not a plot line. It's like, it's core to his personality, right? Like it is like, so yeah, of course there's other, you know, parts of the show who he's dating other people. But like, for me, the banter boy, it's like whoever he is in love with, this character is in love with, is like, says something about who he is as a person, right? And I think that there's something to that with, you know, feeling like, of course, you know, with queer people, like who you're attracted to doesn't define who you are as a person. But I think that it can feel that way, especially when you're closeted or whenever, or when you're a teenager, when you're kind of in that adolescent space of figuring things out. So for me, it was really also like, it was like the Seth, like, yearning for Summer, and Summer like being so hot and cold with him, you know, and that felt so relatable of being like, I want this like unattainable person. And like, there's so many societal things that are in the way of me being with this person. And so then of course, when they end up getting together, it's like the happiest and most satisfying thing in the world.
It's such a wonderful, wonderful analyzation of what, of how we're talking about being attracted to people in real life, but then we're doing it on television as well. And it's a very powerful thing. There's something else that I thought was interesting you commented on in the book, is that his quiet self-confidence, although I don't know that it was so, personally, I think it was like he wanted to make sure, he thought he was the smartest person in the room. Then also his ability to take insults or let insults roll off his back. Mm-hmm. That's something that I started thinking about reading this. And as we've been analyzing the show, that that's actually a superpower in this world, being able to not take, you know, and I did have a question. There were a few things that I guess would be considered inappropriate where Seth says, you know, talking about, okay, got it. You know, when he's supposed to have dinner with Summer's dad, and he says, oh, I get it. Celery's gay. And, and like, can you respond to that or some of these things that were used in an incorrect way or at the, it was at the time. Can you talk about that a bit?
Right. I think you're so right in like his confidence of, letting things roll off his back. Like that to me is so like what I was saying before of like knowing that there's a life outside of Newport. Like that was Seth's superpower that like nobody else on this show had. I mean, maybe Sammy also had it and like Ryan had it in like a different way, but like, you know, so many people on the show are like so stuck in Newport. And so knowing like, you know what, I'm going to college, I'm getting out of here and I'm never going to come back here is like kind of what made him able to have that, that confidence and let things roll off his back. But in terms of like, yeah, it's funny. I think that like, you know, Seth is definitely, you know, Ryan is the super like masculine sort of like archetypical in that way, like bad boy. And Seth is more effeminate. And like, I, you know, that's something that is like super attractive to a lot of people. And, of course he, like everyone calls Seth gay, and it's something where like, that was just the reality of what being in high school in the 2000s was, right? Like that was like kids who like boys who were like, you know, wearing skinny jeans and, you know, I don't know, reading novels just like, you know, the asshole water polo players called them gay. Like that was just like the insult of the time. And so I don't think I like fault the show for including that because it genuinely just feels very realistic.
It reflected reflected what kids did at the time. That doesn't make it okay now, but that is right.
And I think in Seth being like, yeah, whatever, fuck you. Like I don't care if you call me gay. I don't care if Celery's gay, like whatever. It kind of like gives, you know, it was a sign for me to like me as a viewer that it's like, oh, okay, those guys, the guys who are using that as a, you know, a way to punch down at Seth, like those are like Luke's the asshole here. Like Seth's not, you know, at fault for seeming effeminate or whatever. But I think also like, just to like the broader point of like, you know, something in writing this book that I like really didn't want, you know, I write about, you know, of course the OC, but also like Gossip Girl, Harry Potter, you know, The Office, all these kind of like big teen shows at the time. And something that I really wasn't that interested in, and I'm just not in general, is like going back at like old TV and film and being like, oh, that's not, you know, doesn't hold up to our current standards of like, you know, feminism or like gay, like how we talk about queerness or like how we talk about race. Like, I think that it's good to notice that. And I think it's good to be like, oh yeah, like the way that, you know, I in another chapter in the book, I write about Mean Girls, which is like all time favorite movie of mine. But you know, there is like a pretty core plot point in the movie that's like pretty homophobic, like, and is about like somebody, one of the characters is like accused of being a lesbian and everyone's like, oh, that's gross. That's bad. Mm-hmm. I think it's good to be like, oh yeah, that's not, that feels weird. That feels wrong. But like going, I think it's more important to be like, okay, if that's what I was ingesting at the time and that's the sort of, messaging that I was getting, like, what does that say about me? What is that? How did that inform the way that like I view myself or I view other people, rather than being like 2002 is different than 2021 is? Like, that's not that interesting, right? Like, so, you know, I don't think that, yeah, going back and saying like, oh, this show isn't woke is like, what's the point of that? You know?
Right. Yeah. We keep questioning it as we're rewatching it and noticing all these moments. We're like, oh gosh, like you could never, you know, say certain things, do certain things today. And it's just interesting to hear your perspective and not, you know, comparing it or saying it was right or wrong, but it is, we question it a lot.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's good to do that, right? Like it's yeah. instead of just like blindly moving forward with life or whatever, or, right. or being like, oh, we could never say that now. And this sort of like, those were the days kind of way. Well, but instead of being like, oh yeah, like that, that feels like it doesn't belong in this era. Like, what does that say?
Well, you know, right. And that's what you're saying about Mean Girls. That was a plot point. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not, it's not relevant because it's not an insult today.
Yeah.
Maybe exactly. that's the way society has evolved. And that is, I mean, I do think that there's, we can learn so much from shows like the OC that not only reflect the pop culture, but create it. And mm-hmm. so,
yeah,
but, and it was thinking it's these, getting ready for to speak to you really made me reflect on what images really affected me. I was a teenager in the 80s. Rachel, you were a teenager in the mm-hmm. 90s. And I was trying to think about, like, did I have an OC? No, I had MTV. Wow. So mm-hmm. I was looking mm-hmm. at, I didn't think twice about, was Boy George gay? No, or Adam Ant or or Duran Duran or all of these bands. It was just mm-hmm. I was very new romantic and I like to dress like them. But boys and girls, really everyone on MTV wore makeup and it was this very metrosexual kind of time. And mm-hmm. and I think that was, what about you, Rachel? Did you have a TV show that did that?
I would say it would probably have been 90210, the original, yeah. you know, was very yeah. relevant. When I was a kid, even younger than high school. I mean, I was watching it in elementary school, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you look back at all the things they tackled, I mean, I'm sure there's like a well of things. I think they covered it all. But, you know, for me, it was more just like romanticizing like the boyfriend in high school, like the Luke Perry, you know, the Dylan McKay, like that was everything. And like, who's he going to pick? Brenda or Kelly, like those were like the big moments for me.
Yeah.
How growing up.
How weird was it then to like 10 years later be in the show that was like the 90210 of the time, you know?
I know. Pretty surreal. Like when yeah. you can actually be like, oh, this is like the next 902 or whatever, you know, I'm mm-hmm. sure it had some comparisons. Yeah. It was obviously a lot different. But yeah, it was definitely surreal for me to have grown up with such a teen, you know, idolized show and then to kind of fall into this. Mm-hmm. You know, Seth, very different from Dylan McKay, but yeah. but nonetheless, oh. a teen heartthrob.
Right, right.
Well, yes, if Ryan was the Dylan, which character did Josh or I've heard this interview with Josh where I guess that which role, especially by Fox's standards, which role did Seth create or fill? And they were, I guess this question, sorry, it was posed to Stephanie, like which role did he create? And Fox was kind of medium, like we've never had this neurotic Jewish kid that everybody that's become a leading man and could be a sex symbol on the show. And I think that speaks to what was different in this old genre, but the fact that this show had a tonality that hadn't quite been heard before.
Yeah, I think it was like, it felt like it was, you know, especially Seth, it felt like it was just really in touch with how teenagers were at the time. Like it felt like, and I think so much of that like goes to Adam Brody's performance, but like, I think it just felt very like, oh, this is somebody, this person feels so real to me and feels like somebody that I would want to be friends with and like know in my life. And yeah, it didn't feel like it was like people, like older people imagining how teenagers were, but it, mm-hmm. the dialogue, I think just like felt more, just more realistic, more organic.
How old were you when the show came out? And
yeah, I was in eighth grade when it came out. And then I guess I was a junior when it ended. So like really right in that sweet spot too.
Right.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think about being that age watching the show, but like I just said, I guess it was similar to my, I don't really know, feelings and emotions. But do you have any like favorite scenes or like moments from the show that really stood out to you watching it growing up?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this morning, just getting ready. And like one of my, I mean, there are so many, and so much of it is defined around music. And like those, like this show did such a good job of just like pairing that like perfect song with the perfect moment. But like for me, one of like best is the Spider-Man kiss in season two. Like that's like that whole episode too is just like so funny because I mean, you have that, you have the Spider-Man kiss, best payoff ever. And then that's the same episode where you have another one of my favorite moments, which is like, it's when Alex and Marissa are dating and Julie doesn't know. Oh. And there's mm-hmm. that scene in the kitchen where mm-hmm. like whenever Julie turns around, they start making out and then mm-hmm. they stop when she turns back around and she has no idea what's going on and thinks they're friends. Like that's also great, great scene.
Right, right. No, that's one of my favorite episodes. And she yeah. says something to Alex about, I was punk in my day or something.
Oh,
I'm cool,
yeah, yeah.
Right? She's like, she says something like, you know, she's like, I'm just such a cool mom. And then later on she, oh, and then Marissa declares, sorry guys, spoilers, but she declares, mom, she's my girlfriend. And Julie says, yes, I know. I'm glad you have new friends. She's like, no, my girlfriend. And Julie does the mouth drop. Oh.
And yeah, then she like, goes, there's like a thunderclap in that moment too. It's like perfect.
And then she goes to Kirsten and explains, you know, I had my time in, you know, I had my time in college. She's like, you know, yeah. you know, I'm a cool mom.
But that's also, I feel like that's at the point where like Julie starts out in the show and like, you obviously know so much better than I do, but Julie starts out in the show as this, as like a, as a villain, like really a bad guy. But then by that point in season two, she's like a bad guy who's also just so funny that you kind of are just like, it, you know, becomes this very like lovable villain sort of. You're just like, yeah, whatever. Like you're, of course you think you were the cool punk in your day. It's so
great. Right. Do you remember that storyline though? The Olivia Wilde storyline, was that,
yeah.
it wasn't as powerful as the Seth character or?
Yeah. Weirdly Seth, you know, I have such mixed feelings about that storyline because I do think that it was like probably the first like lesbian relationship I saw on TV. So like, there's that. And like certainly in a show that was like where I was the intended audience, you know, I think that was the first one I saw. And like, of course, like Olivia Wilde, like immediately fell in love with Olivia Wilde, impossible yeah. not to. She's so great in that character. I think that it was just, it like, felt even to me as like a freshman in high school, as a 14-year-old, it felt inorganic for Marissa to be dating Alex, you know, like it didn't, it felt a little, you know, it felt like it was sort of meant for shock value. And like, of course, I don't know what the intent was behind it, but I think even at the time as a viewer, and of course, like a viewer who was like full of internalized homophobia at that point, like no idea what's going on with me, but I was sort of like, it seems like they're playing up this kiss a lot in promos, you know, like, it's yeah. like that sort of like the big meat of it. So it's like sort of, it's funny because it's this like proto, like it's kind of like, oh yeah, there was this like lesbian relationship on like primetime TV and this like huge show that like all every teenager watched. But then I think it's still sort of, it's one of the elements of the show that feels a bit dated. And feels a little bit like, oh, this isn't like, you know, like we were talking about before of just like, oh, this isn't how we would play this now, I don't think, you know, right. like it was, but like, also that's just such a fun era of the show because like they have the, what's the name of like the music, the club that
the
Alex
shop.
Runs?
The
yeah,
bait shop.
Shop. Like that's just such a fun era. And like her dating Seth and then dating Marissa is great. So it was, that one was like a little more complicated for me. Mm-hmm. Whereas like Seth, I was just like, nothing's complicated about this. I just right. love this man.
I love that. I had read before, you know, you saying something along those lines. Like it definitely felt more like ratings, you know, inducing
yeah.
and
yeah.
And I get that. And I think there is a more organic way to go about it. And I'd be curious if they did do it again today, how they would have played that storyline out. Because I think there's a lot there. And
yeah.
like you're saying, like watching it, that could have been, you know, done in a more realistic way just for relatable yeah. purposes, you know, I think, but that's true with every television show.
Totally, completely. and like what I really, I think Alex like leaves the show like pretty much right when she and Marissa break up. And like, she's just such a great character that I was like, oh, I want this person to stay around. I want to know more about this person. Like she was one of those where I was like, oh damn, like that would have been cool to like kind of just get more into her life. because she's so great.
Oh, yeah. But I wonder what she went on to do. Yeah.
And then we never saw Olivia Wilde.
And then she disappeared. I know. She's one of the most awesome, cool people just in general, you know, off screen as well. She's just a super special human. So,
yeah. Awesome.
I seem to remember, I think she was offered a series regular and she passed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also Fox, I think Josh wanted to take the storyline bigger, longer, more in depth. And I think Fox kind of shied away from it. That was a reflection of that time. Yeah.
I could see that totally.
I know that they edited certain long kisses.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. It's like so much more about like the creators of the show. It's like the network and what they're like, mm-hmm. you know, doing all of their focus tests about what people are ready for and what people will shy away from. Like it's so much more complicated than just about the show, but it's like, I'm glad that we're not in that space anymore in terms of how TV is and, you know, it's good.
Well, Grace, everyone, read this book. It is super, super entertaining and it's so relatable, gay or straight. I'm still enjoying it. And it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. And
yeah, this is so much fun.
Yeah, we're really happy that you were willing to come on and talk to us. Your book is awesome. I love your writing. I want to watch Moulin Rouge with you and sing all the songs.
Oh my God, yes, any day.
Right,
and dress up as 16 yes. and all of that. But yeah, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And
anytime. Happy to talk about the OC with anyone at any point. So, you know,
thank you.
This is such a pleasure.
Thank you, Grace.
Well, that was really fun. I had a really... really good time talking all things culturally, OC, and else and et cetera.
I've been waiting to talk to Alan since you invited me to do this podcast, Rachel, to be quite honest. Aww. So he was a wonderful guest. And, you know, I think it would be fun. Actually, he should come back right after we finish season 3 and discuss all those storylines.
Yeah, there's lots to get into.
Who
also
knew?
Grace, today we had a really... fun, interesting conversation with Grace Perry as well. I think today was just a lot of fun.
Yes. Yes. The cultural impact that is the OC.
Yes.
Well, anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening. Follow, rate, and review. Welcome to the OC, bitches, wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like us, well, if you like us and you like our faces, why don't you watch us? Check us out on YouTube and HBO Max. What's happened to
Thank
my
you.
Voice there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Shopify presents cool sheets from AHA to...
I suffered from the wrong kind of hot in bed. Heat-induced insomnia. That was my AHA moment. Bed sheets that keep you cool. Then I thought, how do I even sell bed sheets? That's when I had the idea that made it all possible. Signing up on Shopify.
This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a free trial at shopify.com/podcast22. shopify.com/podcast22.
Hi, everyone. It's Rabia Chaudhry.
And I'm Ellen Marsh.
And we have a new podcast called Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case. As you know, I am a very smart lawyer.
You are. You're so well-respected in the entire world. You know everything.
Thank you so much.
And as you know, I'm a famous Broadway star. Gorgeous. I sing like a nightingale.
Well... yes. At least that's what your mom says. Just kidding. This is Ellen Marsh.
And I'm Rabia.
But we are teaming up to bring you a show like you have never heard before.
True crime meets talk show. Nobody's done it. We're going to do it. We're going to do the impossible. And it's the two things that I love. Ellen, I think you like it too.
What? True crime and talking?
Yeah.
I'm there. Every other week, we will have a guest talking about whatever true crime case they are obsessed with. We have a list, everything from the Lacey Peterson murder.
Yeah, some of the most famous cases you've ever heard of, obviously, like JonBenet Ramsey, the West Memphis Three.
Chris Watts, Khalif Browder.
Elisa Lam, Madeleine McCain.
Sandra Bland, the Springfield Three. The list goes on and on. But they are all cases that you know, and we are going to dive in deep with someone else and just talk about them.
No. We're going to solve the case, Ellen.
That's right. We're going to solve the case. So subscribe to Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case wherever you get your podcasts.